ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Srimad Bhagavatam, third canto, chapter 19, the killing of the demon Hiranyaksha, text 23. Tadadite samabhavat, sahasa hridivepatu, smarantya bharta adesham, Stanachastrik prasusruve tadatite samabhavat sahasaridi vepatu smarantya bhartu adesham Stanachastrik prasusruve Tadadite samabhavat sahasa hridi vepatu smarantya bhartu adesham stanachchastrik prasusruve tada at that moment dite of ditti. Samabhavat occurred. Sahasa suddenly. Hridi in the heart. Vepatu a shudder. Smarantya recalling. Part two of her husband. Kashyapa of her husband Kashyapa. Adisham the words, stanat, from her breast, cha, and asrik, blood, prasusruve, flowed. At that very moment, a shudder suddenly ran through the heart of Diti, the mother of Hiranyaksha. She recalled the words of her husband, Kashyapa, and blood flowed from her breasts. Purport. At Hiranyaksha's last moment, his mother, Diti, remembered what her husband had said. Although her sons would be demons, they would have the advantage of being killed by the personality of Godhead himself. She remembered this incident by the grace of the Lord, and her breasts flowed blood instead of milk. In many instances, we find that when a mother is moved by affection for her sons, milk flows from her breasts. In the case of the demon's mother, the blood could not transform into milk, but it flowed down her breasts as it was. Blood transforms into milk. To drink milk is auspicious, but to drink blood is inauspicious, although they are one and the same thing. This formula is applicable in the case of cow's milk also. Om again, it's Chimanandasya. Genanjana Shalakaya Chakshunulitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is a very dramatic moment. Hiranyaksha's last moment before he's killed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yesterday we discussed how the Supreme Absolute Truth, source of everything, includes everything. All types of relationships, all types of activities, whether romance or killing, violence, everything is there, perfectly and pure, without a drop of material contamination. Everything is perfectly there in the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is what we need to understand about the science of God. More and more we're seeing that people have no idea of God. Yet they want to be spiritual. And their idea of spiritual simply turns out to be something that's a little bit different from their ordinary material life. But a little bit different is not enough. You have to understand what is the material energy, what is the spiritual energy, and how both energies of the Lord act. Kalasya Shakti Vidhitaiva Shriyate. The Upanishads state that the Supreme Lord has varieties of energies. So you have to know how each energy acts. You have to know the effects of each energy when you take shelter of it. Now, in Hiranyaksha's last moments before he's being killed, his mother intuitively picks up on the scene. Actually, all living entities are bound up and connected in that they are all part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As Lord Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, Mamaivamsho Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. All living entities are certainly my parts, my amshas. Sarvayonishukontaya Murtaya Sambhavanti. In the 14th chapter of the Gita, Krishna says, I am the seed-giving father of all living entities. Their birth is made possible by the womb of material nature, and I'm the father. Krishna is claiming his paternity. I'm the father. Often, these days, there's doubts. Who are the father? Who's the father of a child? Most of the time, the men who are the fathers, they slink away into the shadows. They don't want to declare their fatherhood. Sometimes they get a bit curious. I wonder what my kid would look like. And they go back to the scene of the crime. Pay a visit to the single mother, you know, see what the kid looks like, you know. Anyway, the government will take care of the kid, you know. She'll get increased money from the government. Oh, what's the problem, you know? But I figured I'd just pay a visit, see what the kid looked like. So, rare it is that someone will come forth, some man these days will come forth and say, oh, I'm the father. But Krishna boldly does that in Bhagavad Gita. You should know, I'm the father. I did it. I put all the living entities in the womb of material nature. Why? Because they wanted to experience life separate from me. I did it. I put them into material nature. You see, we're so dependent that we can't even fulfill our material desires without Krishna helping us. We can't even remember our material desires without Krishna helping us. So he's declaring in Bhagavad Gita that I am the father. I put the living entities in the womb of material nature. Now, because we're all part and parcel of Krishna, there is connection. And these connections between all living entities manifest in different ways, different times. Certainly the connection between mother and son can be very close. And so, it's quite often that when something happens to the son, the mother immediately can pick up on it intuitively because of their close relationship. So many people have had the experience that when one of their material relatives dies, you immediately know. This is because of subtle connections that exist. Material life doesn't simply go on in terms of the gross platform. It's also the subtle platform. Just like in material relationships, often it's not simply the gross body that's connected. It's also the subtle bodies that get all enmeshed in each other. And therefore, when the relationships end, there's a huge process of wrenching apart these subtle bodies. And generally, one person or the other is very disturbed by the process of ripping apart the subtle bodies. Diti, the mother of Hiranyaksha, her breasts are flowing with blood instead of milk because of her sensing that something disastrous is about to happen to her son. in the purport, Prabhupada explains that milk is just blood transformed. But the intelligent person doesn't drink blood. The intelligent person drinks milk. Similarly, you take the blood of the cow in the form of milk. The cow takes grass, a substance that's useless for you as a human being to eat directly, and the cow takes that grass and then the cow turns that into milk. So you take the blood of the cow as milk, but because people are so bloodthirsty, they want the flesh of the cow, the fat of the cow. They want you to eat that. And then they expect there'll be peace in the world, despite all the animal slaughter that's going on. They expect there'll be world peace. No one is trying to understand how all living entities, not simply humans, but all living entities are parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord. And that the government is responsible for all living entities in the nation, not just the human beings. The government should be evaluated as to how it's taking care of all creatures. That is the Vedic understanding of government. You would have a right to ask the Prime Minister, how are you taking care of the sheep? How are you taking care of the cows? But instead, you probably have to ask, how are you taking care of the pet dogs? Have you brought forth any new bills, that new acts that will make life easier for pet owners and their pets? So this is the situation. No one has any understanding of what is actually beneficial for human progress. Taking care of the cows is very beneficial. If people would simply take care of the cows the way they take care of dogs, you'd see a major transformation in society. It's not that they don't have a propensity for taking care of animals. How they take care of dogs is amazing. You go into an opulent pet shop, you'll see air-conditioned dog houses and all sorts of things. Clothes for your doggy. Sometimes they celebrate the birthdays of their dogs, and they exchange cards and gifts. This is going on. So DT's feeling this connection. There are many subtle ways that people are connected. There's nothing so extraordinary, although many people become quite fascinated by these psychic, subtle connections between people. Big deal. Everything in existence is connected. But we, as devotees of the Lord, are interested in the greatest, the purest connection, that is through Krishna's service. But it's a fact. Daily life is simply a bunch of connections. A devotee, the bhakti yogi, watches the quality of the connections to see how it's always for Krishna's pleasure. Otherwise, connections are always going to be there one way or another. If you're interacting with others, which you must, they're going to be connections. So you have to monitor these connections. Look at them. Gross and subtle. See how they're going on for Krishna's pleasure. That is the point. Just like here at the Gaur Yoga Center, we're all very much connected. And we should always be analyzing those connections to see how it's for Krishna's pleasure. When Krishna is pleased, then we'll be pleased. We cannot satisfy each other individually unless Krishna is in the center. Real love is to help someone to advance in Krishna consciousness. When you try to love someone in that way, then Krishna in the heart of that person reciprocates. This exchange of love is also the principle of Sankirtan. I've heard that so many of you are going out today. So, very good. So you're going out to exchange love. It's a love that the ordinary person doesn't recognize, but Krishna is in their heart. And when Krishna sees your sincerity in approaching that person, Krishna, from within the heart of that person, says, take this. You get this book. We're connected like pearls are strung on a thread. The super soul is in everyone's heart. If you please Krishna, then Krishna, from within the heart of everyone, will instruct them how to reciprocate with you. Just like in the Brahma, in the Leela of the Krishna Leela of the Lord interacting with the wives of the Brahmanas. Their husbands, the Brahmanas, wouldn't bring Krishna and Balaram any food. They wouldn't give anything. But their wives did. When the wives heard that Krishna and Balaram and the cowherd boys were hungry, the wives immediately ran off to bring food to Krishna, Balaram, and the cowherd boys. They wanted to stay with Krishna, but Krishna told them to go back. They were worried, maybe our husbands will be a little distressed with us because we disobeyed them. Krishna said, no, don't worry. I'll arrange it so that everything will be all right when you go back. Because the Lord is in everyone's heart. Now, often in Krishna Leela, you read about Mother Yashoda thinking of Krishna with love, and her sari becomes soaked with milk flowing from her breasts. When she was churning the yogurt into butter because she was concerned that baby Krishna was breaking into so many people's houses, stealing milk products, she was thinking maybe he's not satisfied with the milk products available in his own house. So I'll take some milk from special cows that only eat special grasses. And in this way, the milk from these special cows comes out very specially flavored. I'll take that and churn it into butter. I won't even allow my maidservants to do it. I want to do this myself. I'm taking responsibility myself for my child Krishna. I have to do this myself. So while she's churning the yogurt into butter, she's singing songs about Krishna, poetry about Krishna. You see, art is very important in Krishna consciousness, because art conveys the spiritual world. To be Krishna conscious doesn't mean you have to renounce your artistic abilities. It simply means you use them for Krishna's pleasure at the right time and the right place. It may mean that for some years, first you should become purified so that your artistic expression becomes not the projection of your false ego, but because it becomes the projection of devotional service. Your artistic expression can impel people to serve Krishna. So we're not trying to get people to renounce art. Don't play music. Don't make paintings. We're just saying, first become trained. Learn what it's like to be a human being. Then learn what it's like to be a devotee of Krishna. And gradually your artistic expression will become purified so that it can benefit someone. So we want devotees to be alive with the arts. But first they have to learn how to be alive in Krishna consciousness. Krishna consciousness begins with controlling the mind and senses. Without that, spiritual life is not possible. So, devotees who know how to play instruments, or know how to paint, or you have that inclination, see how it turns out for Krishna's pleasure. Make the place come alive with artistic expression for Krishna. Of course, we have so many expressive cooks who prepare such tasty treats offered to the Lord. That's also art. Cooking is art. And then there's music. Yes, you should always be offering musical glorification of the Supreme Lord. And you'll find in that way that your emotions are soothed. You don't have this empty feeling because you're expressing yourself in glorification of the Supreme Lord. We need nice paintings. We need nice music. So everyone can learn how to play harmonium properly, learn how to play mridanga properly, and establish a culture of glorification of the Supreme Lord through artistic expression, cooking, music, art, like that. Of course, receiving guests is also an art. That's part of Vedic culture. It's an artistic activity, how to receive a guest and make that guest feel so comfortable that the guest thinks, I'm at home, or I'm even more comfortable than when I'm at my own home. That's all an art. Serving prasad is an art. You can do so much just by serving the prasad. The way you serve the prasad affects the consciousness of the person. So we want all these things to happen in Krishna consciousness. While Mother Yashoda was churning the yogurt, she was singing poetry about Krishna. Poetry that was common in the village of Vrindavan and poetry that she had made up. All about Krishna's pastimes. Her son, Krishna, was sleeping in another room. Even though he's right there in her house and he's sleeping in another room, she's feeling separation from him. And out of the love and separation, milk flowed from her breasts and wet her sari as she's churning the yogurt into butter. Often in Krishna Lila, you'll read about Mother Yashoda thinking about Krishna and soaking her sari with breast milk, indicating her pure maternal love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In this case, Diti is feeling a shudder that runs through her heart. She remembers the words of her husband who told her, Kashyapa told her, your sons are going to be killed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that moment is about to come. Now why were her sons about to be killed by the Supreme Lord? And why did her husband tell her that? To understand this, we have to go back a bit over some verses you've already read, which are, of course, always suitable for deeper meditation. The history of Lord Bor and Hiranyaksha was described by Lord Brahma. It began with a grihastha couple, Daksha, who's a Prajapati, son of Brahma, and his wife, one of his wives, Diti. At this level of civilization, this is demigod level, a sage could easily have more than one wife, because the Vedic principle is, if a man can handle more than one wife, maintain her, protect her, then he can do so. Because somehow or other in the population there's always more men, there's always more women than men. And especially in a population where a portion of the men in society is becoming brahmachari, that creates even a greater shortage of men. So in order to make sure that every woman has a husband, men who are capable, they can have more than one wife. That's the principle of Vedic culture. Of course, people today think that's horrible. But people today, they don't even bother to marry one wife or husband. And certainly they know nothing about how to care for someone properly, materially or spiritually. As we discussed yesterday, they just become partners, which means, hey, it looks like I'm interested in you for a while. Looks like you're interested in me for a while. Let's just, you know, we'll have a partnership to see how it turns out. And even in the case when someone does marry, a man does marry, we can see that it's a full-time occupation, a man handling one wife. Who can handle more? One is enough to fill your plate. But someone like Daksha is different. So he married 13 daughters. excuse me, Kashyapa married 13 daughters of Daksha. Daksha is the father of Diti, and Kashyapa married not only Diti, but 12 or so other daughters of Daksha. One of them is Sati, the wife of Lord Shiva. So in that way, Diti and Kashyapa are related to Lord Shiva through marriage. So, even at this high level of existence, there's some problems. Heavenly planet's life doesn't mean you're immune from problems. The Bhagavatam describes that Diti was afflicted with sex desire and begged her husband Kashyapa for such relations in order to beget a child. What was her husband, Kashyapa, doing? He was in meditational trance, offering oblations to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vishnu. He was sitting in front of the sacrificial fire, meditating on the Supreme Lord. But Diti became overwhelmed by desires, and even though her husband's in trance, meditating, she's interrupting, speaking loudly. She's telling him that she's very much distressed by lust, and just like a banana tree is troubled by a mad elephant. A mad elephant can grab a banana tree with its trunk and just shake it. So she's saying, she's feeling like that. She says, therefore you should be kind towards me by showing me complete mercy. I desire to have sons, and I am much distressed by seeing the opulence of my co-wives. By performing this act, you will become happy. She's got it all figured out. By doing this, you'll be happy. A woman is honored in the world by the benediction of her husband, and a husband like you will become famous by having children, because you are meant for the expansion of living entities. Now, it's a little hard for not only contemporary men, but also contemporary ladies today to understand Diti's situation. It's not that she was simply lusty for that particular activity. No, there was all sorts of other things combined with that which were creating such an intensity. She wanted children. So it wasn't, you see, in current so-called civilization, there's a complete disconnection between the procreative activity and children. No one puts the two together because people have no understanding of Dharma and the regular principles. Everyone understands the procreative act is one thing, children are another thing. But in Vedic culture, there's no question of separating these two things. These two things are fused. They're not fused together, they are one thing. It's just that the current demoniac civilization has split this one thing apart. So there can be the reproductive activity, which is completely distinct, completely separate from children, having children. That's because of this demoniac contraception, which totally allows an unnatural lifestyle, in which both the men and the women become depleted of all energies, they become deranged, they become weak-minded. But in Vedic culture, real human civilization, there's no question of separating reproduction from having children. So, in this way, because of the society today being so deviant, it may be a bit hard to understand DT's emotions. That it's not simply she's disturbed by wanting to engage in that particular activity. She's disturbed because she wants children. And what's making that desire for children even more intense is that every one of her co-wives has children. She's the only one who doesn't have children. So this is making things really intense. So it's a situation all combined together. The emotional, the physical. There's the emotional desire for children, the physical attacks of lust. It's all making one package, and she's presenting it to Kashyapa. Now, Kashyapa is not opposed to her having children, but he knows this is the wrong time. This is against the regular principles. But Diti is not going to allow him to function properly. She's going to be unreasonable. And he's going to be weak. Instead of just telling her, no, this is improper. These things should go on according to Dharma. He's going to offer very weak protests and fall under her control. She's going to end up just grabbing his cloth, and then Kashyapa will offer his obeisances to fate. Like, he knows this is going to result in inauspiciousness, but we'll read a bit of what happened before that. She, of course, knows how to speak very eloquently. O lotus-eyed one, kindly bless me by fulfilling my desire. When someone in distress approaches a great person, his pleas should never go in vain. So Maitreya explains to Vidura that Diti was afflicted by the contamination of lust and therefore poor and talkative. She was saying like this. And as we said before, Prabhupada makes the point, Kashyapa could have refused her with strong words, saying, impossible, not now. But he was not so strong. In other words, he was already inclined to come under her control. And so therefore he spoke some weak words. He said right from the outset, O afflicted one, I shall gratify whatever desire is dear to you, for who else but you is the source of the three perfections of liberation? And then he begins to speak about how it's necessary to have a good wife for crossing the dangerous ocean of the material existence. And that is true. But a good wife, as the purport described, is one who is Dharma Patni, a companion to the husband in the execution of Dharma. Diti is going to be condemned even to the point of the Bhagavatam referring to as Vrishali, prostitute, because even though she's engaging in relations with her husband, it is not according to Dharma. And so therefore, the purports make the strong point that a wife who gratifies her husband against the regular principles is indeed indulging in prostitution. Now this, many people find to be like, ridiculous. This is bizarre. Get real. First of all, there's nothing wrong with 12-year-olds doing this. What to speak of a man who actually married a woman? Get real. There's no wrong in this activity anytime, any place, anywhere. But now you're going to tell us that someone who actually went through the antiquated ritual of getting married, and then they're having relations. You're saying that's wrong? This is too much. I noted in my travels around New Zealand, if there's one thing people know about Hare Krishnas, it's this. Are you the ones who believe that? You ever had that experience? People say that. Oh, you guys, you're the ones who, you think like this. First of all, they don't even bother to get married. So, but they think if someone does go through all that trouble and still you guys are on their case, get real. Sometimes even our own members in the Hare Krishna movement say that. Anyway, the standard is there in the books for those who want to follow it. We're not going to, you know, patrol everyone's house and see it. put you know, video cameras everywhere. The standard's there. We will say what the standard is. We will speak about that, and yeah, those who want to follow, they'll follow. Those who want not to follow, they won't follow, and they'll just have to experience getting kicked by the material energy. That is our position. Individually, I don't get into this with persons, you know, get into their private affairs individually, but I'll just publicly speak the general standard. Now, it is true what Kashyapa is saying. Although he's being a bit generous, he's really going to lay it on thick in talking to his wife. He's going to call her, oh, Griheshwari, oh, queen of the home. Oh, respectful one. A wife is so helpful that she's called the better half of a man's body. A man can move without anxiety, entrusting all responsibilities to his wife. As a fort commander, very easily conquers invading plunderers. By taking shelter of a wife, one can conquer the senses, which are unconquerable in the other social orders. There's truth in what he's saying. And as you see, Prabhupada will respond in the purports. There is truth, but still, he's laying it on a bit too thick. It's kind of it's a motivated presentation. Because he's about to give in, and he knows it. But being a sage, he's got to say it all very eloquently, you know. Oh, worshipful deity of the home. Oh, respectful one. You can fulfill all this and that, and you are the fort that protects the senses. On and on and on. Finally, Diti just basically says, enough of this. This grabs his glove. But Kashyapa does warn her. He does warn her. But he's not strong enough to walk his talk. That is the problem. He's not strong enough to walk his talk. He points out to her, yes, I can fulfill your desires, but not now. This is the wrong time. He knows it. But he can't walk his talk, and therefore he just offers his obeisances to fate. Well, I guess, you know, this was just meant to be. This is, what can I do? What can you do? This is often a problem in Krishna conscious marriages, that the husband doesn't walk his talk, and therefore the wife actually doesn't respect him. I was telling this to some couples in Melbourne. The husband wants to, you know, take the Vedic control of the family, but then the wife knows, yeah, you talk like that now. Yeah. We know where you really are. And so, that's what goes on, you know. You know, the husband, on one hand, wants to be the leader of the home, and you do what I say, that's proper, and you know, I'm the leader of the family. But the wife's thinking, yeah. You're talking big now, but when Cupid's arrows start to pierce you, we know where you're at. And so then the man's compromised. So this is what's happening with Kashyapa. He's compromising himself, even though he knows what is what. Now, for the upkeep of society, for the proper maintenance of a human society, it's very important that men are trained as brahmacharis and ladies are trained to be chaste. That's basically what we're doing here at our Gaur Yoga operations. We're foremost teaching the ladies how to be chaste, and we're preparing those men who are able or willing for brahmachari life, which means the conscious acceptance of a regulated, disciplined lifestyle of training. Not that simply to be brahmachari means to throw on saffron cloth and then just do whatever you like. No. Srila Prabhupada writes that very important point. Unless there is rigid and systematic training of the brahmachari by the expert spiritual master, and unless the student is obedient, it is sure that the so-called brahmachari will fall prey to the attack of sex. In other words, there's no point in having a brahmachari ashram unless there is rigid and systematic training of the brahmacharis, and unless the brahmacharis are obedient. First of all, it's rare to find a brahmachari ashram these days. And secondly, you find that there's no obedience there. There's no rigid and systematic training. You just, hey, that room up on top of the temple, that's the brahmachari ashram. You know, you throw on some saffron, and you live up there, and yeah, you do whatever you like. That's not what the Shastra has in mind. So it's necessary that men who are willing should be brahmacharis in training. They have to be willing. Better if one is not able to accept that lifestyle of menial obedient service to just say, it's not for me, and still go on with your Krishna consciousness. But some portion of the society should be trained as brahmacharis. That's the point. It's not that you're doomed if you cannot adopt that lifestyle. Yes, we have other alternatives for you. Just like here we have the contemporary Vedic ashram. It's an alternative for those who either haven't made up their minds yet, whether they can be a brahmachari or not, or they've decided they can't, but still they can become Krishna conscious. Actually, as I was telling Ishwarapur yesterday, the standard in our contemporary Vedic ashram is higher than most so-called brahmachari ashrams in the world. But we are trying to establish classic brahmachari ashrams, just like we've done that in Auckland. And there, you consciously embrace a lifestyle of menial service in terms of distributing Krishna's glories, a lifestyle of obedience, simplicity, studying the Shastra, basically reading the books and distributing the books, glorifying Krishna, being the humble servant. That's it. To most people, that would sound very stark, empty. But actually, the brahmachari has a chance to realize Krishna as a Supreme Personality of Godhead without so many possible distractions. The simplicity of the lifestyle allows for rapid immersion in Krishna consciousness. So true brahmachari life is very necessary for at least a part of society. And as for the ladies, they're always meant to be trained to be chaste. And I can see that because that is so here, we're saved so many problems, complications, because the men and women aren't in each other's face all the time. It's very auspicious that the men and women live in different places. Can you imagine what it would be like to just live in the same building all the time? Constantly walking past each other in the hallway, on and on, day in, day out. I know that during the time when we have preaching programs, you know, there is a bit of intermingling. But can you imagine that just nonstop with no respite? Your minds would just become like, you know, mush. All day and all night. Would it be this one? Will it be that one? It's just natural. That's the way the material mind works. So better to just let everybody chill out in their respective abodes. And also, not simply the men, but the ladies. It would do them well to have a time where they can focus on their own Krishna consciousness. We're not blind to the obvious fact that almost every lady will choose to go into family life at some point in life. But at least why not give them the chance to become absorbed in devotional service for some portion of their life so they can see it is possible. And maybe that training will carry over into their family life and they'll still be able to have a very serious level of commitment in devotional service. The foremost thing that ladies are taught is how to be chaste. How to live without having to allure a man at every moment. And when we say allure a man, we're not blaming the women, because guess what? The men want to be allured. So how can the ladies live without all the time alluring a man? It takes two to tango. So, as I said, it's not just the lady's fault, it's the fault of material existence, and it's our fault because we chose to come to material existence. And in material existence, this is what goes on. As Lord Vrishabhadeva says, Pum sastya mitini bhavamitam, teor mito hideya grantamahu. The attraction between the male and female is the basis of material existence. The hard knot in the heart forms. And then based on that hard knot in the heart, whether you call it marriage or partnership or whatever, based on that hard knot in the heart, so many complications of life come about. In the classic traditional society, of which there's not much left of that today, then you have Atola Griha Kshetra, Sutapta Vittaya, Janasya Mohoyamahamameti. Once the hard knot in the heart is there, then griha, there has to be a home, kshetra, land, sutta, vittaya. There has to be relatives and animals and wealth. And this way, Janasya Mohoyamahamameti, life's illusions increase. So nowadays, what would you say? There's a hard knot in the heart that for at least a weekend. And then, well, everyone's already got their flats. So, what? Then you've got to figure out all sorts of other complications of how you're going to share the relationship, how to protect your assets. When the relationship falls apart, you don't want to lose your assets. So many other complications. What kind of contraception system you're going to use. It's very important for relationships. How to tell the other one that you're not interested anymore. This is part of the complication. I just saw there's a best-selling book out now written for ladies. It's called When to admit he's just not into you. How to read his actions, because he won't say with his lips. How to read his actions and know he's just not into you anymore. The theory of this book is that it's actually terrifying for most men to just admit that, you know, I just don't like you anymore. So rather than say that, men go through all these kind of rituals and actions. I was too busy to call. You got to understand, I was having a hectic day. So the book warns the ladies, don't accept that excuse. How much time do you think does it take for him to press a speed dial button on his mobile phone and call you? Don't accept what he says. He's lying. Face the facts. He's just not into you. So, this book is a top seller now. All the ladies are gobbling it up. Yeah, this is what we need to know. Yeah. All these problems can be avoided if one simply knows how to have relationships like a human being. Then you don't have to get into all these complications and buy books, and study the books. How do you know when he's not into you? Don't become involved in relationships unless there is commitment. This is the word everyone fears. This is the word modern men fear, commitment. Ooh. Why does it have to be commitment? I remember when I was at university, one of my friends, he was cohabiting with his girlfriend, and so she asked him, drop the hint, when's the marriage going to be? I'll never forget his answer. He just looked at her, he told me, he looked at her and said, I'm too young to die. I'm just 21 years old, too young to die. Marriage, why? We have everything, already. It's all going on, It's a very, very nice life, having a girlfriend without commitment. You're supplying all the benefits, so what, marriage? Because in a traditional society, that was the woman's natural emotional need for emotional security. And most men are totally oblivious to that. Emotional security? What the hell is that? That's basically, basically what a man feels. Emotional security? Huh? Even when they try to understand, it's hard for them to understand. So, all these kind of problems can be avoided simply by having relationships based on commitment. But people can't understand it. What's the purpose of a commitment? Just to be with each other? Well, even if it's just that, that's something. That's civilization. Commitment without divorce. Commitment without whimsically breaking it. At least that's a proper basis of material civilization. I was just reading an article about Indians in the USA. Indians who come from India to the USA. They have the highest income of any immigrant group in the USA. And their divorce rate amongst the Indians in the USA is 2%. Because they have family stability. And, of course, most Indians don't understand the Dharma that their Hinduism is based on, that their cultural traditions are based upon. They just, you marry. Generally, the father and the mother of the boy and girl, they meet and they pick each, they decide whether this match is suitable, and the son does what the parents say and the daughter does what the parents say, and they have a marriage. It still goes on like that for the most part. In only a small percentage of cases, even amongst Indians who live in the West, are there the so-called love marriages. Almost always it's arranged by the parents. Just like I have Indian disciples and aspiring disciples, quite a few in Melbourne. And, the boy will just tell me, my parents have a girl waiting for me at home. And, you just do what your parents say. Yeah. That's just the way it is. Mm. Now, to you all, it might sound like, I mean, don't you want to fall in love with the person first? In other words, don't you want to fall in lust with the person first? But that's not the classical Vedic system, and it's not the best system. The best system is first commitment, and then all the other things come. But the Kali Yuga system is first all the other things, and then maybe commitment. So, Diti's and Kashyapa's marriage was arranged. Diti and her other 12 sisters, They went to their father, Daksha. Well, they actually didn't go to the father, Daksha. The father divined their wishes by talking to their grandmother, because the girls would be too shy to express that to their father, who was the man of their choice. Sometimes it's done that way. It's not simply always arranged without consulting. In this case, Daksha consulted, and the girls went to their grandmother and said, And so then Daksha found out about the father, and he married them all off to Kashyapa, because he all wanted Kashyapa. So there's, it's not like a completely fascistic system, inhumane. Why don't people look at the way they're living now and see how inhumane that is, how trashy that is? I've told you all so many times how my heart breaks to see how these young girls are just practically forced into virtual prostitution at the age of 13 and 14. Basically, prostitution without pay. It's mentioned in the purports there that women are tortured by illicit sex. The men are actually torturing them. The women, of course, don't see it that way. They think it's all part of being wanted, being desirable, having a partner, not being alone. But they are simply setting themselves up for torture. They're offering themselves for torture. They don't see it like that. No, we're just, you know, expressing life and love and all that kind of stuff. So it really breaks my heart to see that. How it goes on at such a young age, destroying the human potential. Now, according to Vedic culture, the grihasthas are actually responsible for maintaining all the other statuses of life. The grihasthas are meant to maintain the brahmacharis, the sannyasis, and the vanaprasthas. They're meant to maintain, that is, the celibate students and the official monks. They're all meant to be maintained by the householders. So when there's not a proper householder ashram, you just have a civilization of cats and dogs, which is going on today. Now, what Kashyapa is telling Diti is true, as we said, to a certain extent, that the wife is supposed to protect the man from disturbing society by chasing young girls and corrupting them. The wife is supposed to be the fort. And so that the man has his legitimate outlet for those desires, according to Dharma. And that is the point. So what Kashyapa is saying certainly has some value. He's just into it a bit too much. O queen of the home, we are not able to act like you, nor can we repay you for what you have done, even if we worked for our entire life, or even after death. To repay you is not possible, even for those who are admirers of personal qualities. You can remember this one. We cannot repay you for what you've done, even if we work for our entire life, or even after death. Because Prabhupada puts in one of his special purports, in comment to this verse, he says, so much glorification of a woman by her husband indicates that he is henpecked. Or he is talking lightly in joke. So it's a double, you have to see both sides. And yes, Srila Prabhupada is careful to present both sides. He's not saying, oh, this is just all rubbish. No, he's saying there is great value in what Kashyapa is saying, but he's just going a bit too far, pressed by the particular situation he's in. So he says, Kashyapa says to her, but very weakly. He's already under her control. Now, there's nothing wrong if the control is for Krishna's pleasure, But he's falling under the control of a wife who is going to push him to act against Dharma. So therefore it's condemned. He tells her, even though it is not possible to repay you, I shall satisfy your sex desire immediately for the sake of begetting children, but you must wait for only a few seconds so that others may not reproach me. This particular time is most inauspicious. Why? Because at this time in the evening, the ghosts are out and Lord Shiva's about. Kashyapa, he can see all that. He can see these horrible looking ghosts. He can see Bhutesh, Lord Shiva, the Lord of the Ghosts. He sees it all happening around. There's some people even today who they see ghosts. So Kashyapa could see all that. And he knows that all these creatures, especially Lord Shiva, they'll witness our procreative activity. And it'll be an offense for us to indulge at this time in the presence of Lord Shiva. And even worse is that because we are breaking the regular principles, one of these ghouls will take birth as a product of our conception, of our activity for conceiving a child. We'll give birth to a demoniac child. So he's cautioning her. We don't want to offend Lord Shiva. Because not only is it bad to offend Lord Shiva, as we said, but also Lord Shiva looks for householder couples who are engaged in illicit sex, not according to time and place, not according to Dharma, and he inserts into the womb of the woman a demoniac child, generally a child who's been a ghost before, because Lord Shiva has mercy on the ghosts. They're suffering so much without a gross body, but if they follow Lord Shiva, he mercifully says, okay, here's a suitable womb to take birth in. They don't follow the regular principles. They're unclean. So, and you can get a human body in that way. So this is how the population becomes more and more hellish. So many ghoulish creatures take birth because of the parents' inability to conceive a child in proper consciousness. So Daksha is warning her. But what's Diti going to do? She was thus informed by her husband, but she was pressed by Cupid. So she caught hold of the clothing of Kashyapa, the great sage, just like a shameless public prostitute. Prabhupada writes in the purport, the difference between a married wife and a public prostitute is that one is restrained in sex life by the rules and regulations of the scriptures, whereas the other is unrestricted in sex life and is conducted solely by the strong sex urge. Although very enlightened, Kashyapa, the great sage, became a victim of his prostitute wife. Such is the strong force of material energy. So these are the parts of Prabhupada's books that even some devotees don't like. Well, let's edit that out. That doesn't apply to today. You've heard that in Sweden? Yes, it goes on everywhere. Oh, these parts of Prabhupada's books aren't relevant. Maybe the books aren't relevant. Yes, I realize that Srila Prabhupada, he's written his books in such a way that if you actually read his books and distribute the books, the Hare Krishna movement will go on as Prabhupada wanted. These books are really hard to tamper with. They don't compromise. So if you really want to change things, you've got to get rid of Prabhupada's books. They're really a problem. Statements like this, became a victim of his prostitute wife. Come on, get real. What do you want? A person's married, But Prabhupada's books are giving us a different standard. We're not going to force it on people like some kind of Islamic, you know, law that will behead you if you don't follow this, but it's our duty to make the standard known. That's all. It is a fact that it's better that such unrestricted activity goes on within marriage than outside of marriage. There's no doubt about that. Sometimes that defense is given. That, well, okay, I know it's not the standard, but hey, at least it's with my wife, at least it's with my husband. It's not like I'm going around, you know, whimsically here, there. That is true. And it is true that such unrestricted activity in marriage is not as sinful as outside of marriage. That is true. Nevertheless, it is also true that for those in marriage who don't follow the regular principles, they won't make any spiritual advancement. It's like you're treading water. You know, everyone knows how to tread water, right? You just make a lot of exertion, you don't go anywhere. So similarly, that's what happens when householders don't follow the principles. They kind of hang in there in a certain way, all right, but they don't make any spiritual advancement. Now you may say, well, fair enough, at least I'm hanging in there in Krishna consciousness. But you see, what also happens, I've noticed over the years what happens in that case, is that they get tired, and then they start to blame the process. I've been following for 20 years. I don't have any taste. Where's Krishna? Where's the Krishna that was promised me? They actually get tired because, yeah, you will get tired of just treading and going nowhere. And then you blame the process. Like, what's wrong with this pool? What's wrong with the water? I'm not going anywhere. Well, why don't you start swimming properly? So this is the danger of that kind of approach. You won't get the taste you need to sustain you in spiritual life, and then you'll just kind of drop your Krishna consciousness because of no taste. It's true. Some are able to just tread water like that and just go on year after year. Not very enlivened, but at least they're hanging in there. You can generally, when I travel, you can always tell places where householders follow the regular principles. They're all shiny and sparkly in the face. Otherwise, they get this ashen look on their faces and, you know, kind of look all wilted, like a wilted flower. So one has to decide what one wants. We're just going to speak the standard and make the information available. And then those who want to follow that will follow that. Those who won't, they won't. They'll have to learn for a while that, you know, they're not going to make any spiritual advancement. Yeah, they'll go on in some way. And yes, it is better than going outside of marriage, just living together or having casual connections. Definitely, it's not as sinful as that. There's no doubt about that. We're not going to deny it. And often that's the defense. Well, what do you want me to do? I got to do something with these desires. It's better I do it all within marriage. That is true. But still understand that if you're interested in spiritual advancement, it's not going to happen. You'll just tread water. You'll just stay where you're at, and you won't make spiritual advancement. And that means your taste won't increase, and then you run the risk of just getting frustrated with Krishna consciousness and blame the process. So we don't individually chastise devotees for these lifestyle problems. We don't personally get involved with it. We just let the standard be known. Everyone knows, and so what the standard is, and so. These things do happen, and so basically you can just say, all right, just when you're ready to follow the regular principles, you'll make spiritual advancement. That's all. We're not going to start a whole inquisition. Understanding his wife's purpose, he was obliged to perform the forbidden act. And thus, after offering his obeisances unto worshipable fate, he lay with her in a secluded place. So Kashyapa knew. The child born of this improper relation is not going to be a good child. But he couldn't protect himself because he was too much under his wife's control. He felt too obligated to her. So then afterwards, what was Diti's reaction? Diti, after this, went nearer to her husband. Her face lowered because of her faulty action. What starts off as nectar turns into poison. Prabhupada writes, when one is ashamed of an abominable action, one naturally becomes downfaced. Diti came to her senses after the abominable sexual intercourse with her husband. Oh, people hate this. What do you mean? Get real. Sorry. What can we do? Edit that purport. Some devotees even say, take that out of there. With abominable sexual intercourse with one's husband. It's impossible. Oh, it gets even worse. Such sexual intercourse is condemned as prostitution. These are the books you're distributing? Are you really sure you want to go on with this process? Is it inhumane? Prabhupada still doesn't stop. In other words, sex life with one's wife is equal to prostitution if the regulations are not properly followed. So, DT knows, I've done wrong. She's not an ordinary woman. She knows the cosmic principles, the way life works. So, she's clever also. She's coming to her husband saying, please, let's pacify Lord Shiva so he doesn't kill my child in the womb because of the great offense I've made against him. She's trying to have it both ways. I'm sorry, but also, I don't want Lord Shiva, in response to this offense, to cause the child in the womb to die. So, you know, let's try to do something. let's try to figure out, you know, how we can preserve the situation. Let me offer my obeisances unto the angry Lord Shiva. And then she says, he's very ferocious, but he's also auspicious and forgiving. In other words, he's not simply fierce. He can also forgive. And that's what I need right now. Even though I know I've done wrong, I need some forgiveness. Diti is very clever. Let him be pleased with us, since he's my brother-in-law. He's the husband of my sister. He's also the worshipable lord of all women. Just like you remember in the 10th canto Bhagavatam, the gopis worshipping Lord Shiva in order to get a good husband. They actually wanted Krishna. So it's very, you can worship the demigods for pleasing Krishna, and not otherwise. The great sage Kashyapa thus addressed his wife, who was trembling because of fear that her husband was offended. She understood that he had been dissuaded from his daily duties of offering evening prayers. Yet she desired the welfare of her children in the world. In other words, she's already into mother mode. This is actually, regardless of the violation, in terms of time and place, it's actually proper civilized attitude. He knows. The activity is meant for conception. I've engaged in the activity that I've conceived. And so, immediately, she's already thinking for the welfare of her children. I don't want Lord Shiva's wrath to get involved in this. So let's beg forgiveness from Lord Shiva so that my life can go on according to my plan. Now, Kashyapa is going to speak authoritatively. He should have said this before, but now afterwards, Kashyapa is going to speak in a strong way. Because of your minds being polluted, number one. Number two, because of defilement of the particular time. Number three, because of your negligence of my directions. And number four, because of your being apathetic to the demigods, everything was inauspicious. Why did he say that before? So he said some very heavy things to her about what is going to be the outcome of this procreation. Completely inauspicious. Number one, your mind was polluted. Number two, you ignored the rules of time, place, and circumstance. And you had this happen at a most inauspicious time when all the ghouls and ghosts are about. Now, you neglected my directions. And you offended the demigods who are watching everywhere. So therefore, nothing auspicious will come out of this. He says, O haughty one, you will have two contemptuous sons born of your condemned womb. Unlucky woman, they will cause constant lamentation to all the three worlds. They will kill poor, faultless living entities, torture women, and enrage the great souls. At that time, the Lord of the universe, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the well-wisher of all living entities, will descend and kill them, just as Indra smashes the mountains with his thunderbolts. So there's Kashyapa's prediction. He knows. He can see. As a sage, he can see what the outcome to particular activities are. Now, what is Diti's response? She's also not a normal woman. She has her weaknesses, but hey, after all, she's the daughter of Daksha. This you're dealing with a very high level of entities, practically like the highest level of entities in the universe, in the material universe. So she says, it is very good that my sons will be magnanimously killed by the arms of the Personality of Godhead with his Sudarshan weapons. She knows. If my sons are killed personally by Vishnu, they'll get liberation. So it's very good. She's just worried that they may get killed, as she says, by the wrath of Brahmana devotees. She doesn't want that. Even though she knows her sons are going to enrage the Brahmana community, she doesn't want the Brahmanas to kill her son. She says, it's very good that my sons will be killed by the Supreme Personality of God in himself. So she knows. But then, you see, things are not one-sided in the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is so beautifully able to deal with a multi-dimension situation. And life is multi-dimensioned. Life is multifaceted. So, Diti was, she was mixed. She had real lamentation. At the same time, she's cagey and clever. Let's please Lord Shiva. We offended him. I'm sorry. But also, we don't want him getting angry with us and punishing us. She's got all these things mixed together. So, Kashyapa tells her, after informing her that her sons will be killed by Vishnu, he says, because of your lamentation, penitence, and proper deliberation. Lord, because she's repenting to some degree. And also because of your unflinching faith in the Supreme Personality of Godhead and your adoration for Lord Shiva and for me, one of the sons of your son, your grandson, in other words, will be an approved devotee of the Lord, and his fame will be broadcast equally with that of the Personality of Godhead. Who is that grandson? Kamad Maharaj. So then, Kashyapa goes on to forecast the glories of Prahlad Maharaj. So then what was Diti's emotional reaction? Hearing that her grandson would be a great devotee and that her sons would be killed by Krishna, Diti was highly pleased in mind. So it's a mixed situation, you see. She's, as Kashyapa said, because you are an unflinching devotee of the Lord, you just had a weak moment. So there'll be good and bad in this situation. So Diti's pleased in her mind. Okay, I did something stupid, but still there'll be some benefit. As Prabhupada writes in the purport, Diti was very aggrieved to learn that because of her untimely pregnancy, her sons would be demons and would fight with the Lord. But when she heard that her grandson would be a great devotee and that her two sons would be killed by the Lord, she was very satisfied. As the wife of a great sage and the daughter of a great Prajapati, Daksha, she knew that being killed by the personality of Godhead is a great fortune. Since the Lord is absolute, his acts of violence and nonviolence are both on the absolute platform. This is what you need to understand. So, we'll end by pointing out that she knew that the sons within her womb were going to cause such disturbance in the world. Therefore, she kept the sons in her womb for 100 years. She didn't want to let them out, knowing that they're going to cause havoc throughout the world. She carried them for 100 years. All right. Any questions? Yes. Is that your program? Those householders who follow the regular principles, they become very powerful. I've seen householders who have followed the regular principles all their life. They're as powerful as sannyasis. The ones who actually follow. And everyone knows the ones who follow. Because the wives talk.
My husband.
And also, those householders who strictly follow, they advocate the benefits of that. Whereas others, they don't talk about it. So, if you choose your ashram and follow it legitimately, there's great power there in any of the ashrams. Okay, if you can fast, then fast, but otherwise, you can fast another way by following the rules and regulations of Grihastha Ashram. So it's a question of choosing what ashram will be most effective for you to go back to Godhead. Generally, marriage means work, bills, money. No time. Generally. But man and woman want to be together, so let it happen in Krishna consciousness. We're not blind to the realities. Most men will marry. Almost every woman will marry. That's just the way it is. Now, what you make of your married life, that's up to you. So we're giving a balanced presentation. Otherwise, each ashram can make its propaganda. We're not interested in propaganda. We're interested in the actual realities and how to deal with those. just like sometimes young grihastas when they're giving Bhagavatam class. Not only young, but older ones too. So there's a natural Vedic sequence. You're a brahmachari, and then you become a grihasta. And then it's automatic. And then you get the young brahmacharis giving class. Yeah, just avoid that maya. When I was a young brahmachari, I made up a certain mantra. This is 30 years ago. Before I became more balanced. This is a marriage mantra I gave. Dive in, take a swim, splash around, then you drown. Anyway, as I say, that's propaganda. Beyond the platform of propaganda for this ashram or that ashram is the point that if you follow your ashram properly, there's power there. There's no doubt we have to tell the truth. If you can actually remain free from all that, it's easier. But you actually have to remain free from all. I've found over the years that the main thing that you're wrestling with and you master is how to be loving without the Kali Yuga stuff wrapped up with it. That's ultimately what one has to master by the ashram system. Because everyone wants to love. Everyone wants to be loved. How do you show love without the traditional way of male-female expression? That's what someone has to learn if they want to go the distance without marriage in Krishna consciousness. Because sooner or later the heart becomes affected. I want to feel reciprocation, this, that, the other. Yet there's so many devotees all around, yet you just realize. So how do you satisfy that in Krishna consciousness? Why does the propensity to love automatically mean there has to be male-female interaction? That is the question. That's something you have to learn to deal with. It's easiest for someone who's preaching to understand that. Because someone who's preaching, someone who's distributing Krishna consciousness, is always giving love. And so it just takes you a while to realize that, hey, I'm already loving. What else is there? There's nothing more to do than this. But it just takes you a while to penetrate to the depths of that activity of distributing Krishna consciousness and see how it is the love supreme. It takes some time and patience. And many persons in Krishna consciousness don't have that patience. And we're not going to terrorize them for that. No, there are four ashrams. So that's mainly what is to be dealt with, the love thing. The desire just to relate to someone. Preaching Krishna consciousness, distributing Krishna consciousness is giving the greatest love to everyone. So the more you start to realize that, the more you become established in your renunciation. Learn how to care for people properly, devoid of sense gratification. So, yes, 30 years ago I might have said such a mantra. And then Krishna always has the last laugh. Now I have so many sons and daughters. I certainly don't tell them that mantra when they marry. I pray that they'll have a Krishna conscious marriage. There'll be difficulties in their marriage, but if they're understanding that Krishna consciousness is the main thing, then they'll pass over these difficulties. There's no doubt that as the years go by, it's easier and easier to live a single life, especially if you're properly associating with your God brothers. It's actually, as any man knows, men really like to hang out with men. It's just that there's some things that men can't do for you. And if you're not into those things, life is pretty simple. So, it's one of the joys of sannyasis to hang out with each other. You know, we don't have any wife to go home to, so no kids screaming at us, so we can just hang out, you know, be mates. You know, enjoy life, you know. Chanting, dancing, you know. That becomes more and more apparent as you become older. And naturally also, as you age, you become more, you know, affectionate in a fatherly way. That's just something that naturally happens as you get older. Instead of being affectionate in a romantic way, you become affectionate in a fatherly way. But life becomes very peaceful when you do things without the demand for sense gratification in return. So we're not presenting propaganda. We're presenting the realities. And we try to show that by helping all devotees, no matter what ashram they're in, to have the best chance to become Krishna conscious. And the whole point of our operation here, or one of the points, that is to give everyone a chance to be all they can be. For a lady, that means learn how to be chaste. That's why quite a few of the ladies, as soon as they come here, I tell them, look, just forget about the guys for a few years. Just chill out for some time. You've had enough. You've had your quota. Especially here in New Zealand, you know, where the standard for, you know, normal life is that the girls shack up with their boyfriends at their parents' house at the age of 14 with the blessings of the parents. So, there's no question of inexperience and curiosity, for the most part. Everyone's already overdosed. So we just get them to chill out for some time, you know. Learn how to be chaste. Learn how to, that you can make it from day to day without, you know, these things. Get some self-respect, in other words. Get some dignity. If you don't have self-respect and dignity for yourself, then you won't care for yourself, and you won't care whether you're Krishna conscious or not. And for the men, we offer the contemporary Vedic ashram where they can start to stabilize, try to, you know, regather their dissipated intelligence, and, you know, come out of the fog. Because the men think it's all a great fun, you know, plundering, torturing all the girls. It's a sport, you know. They don't understand. The men don't understand. They're ruining themselves. They're just making their brains so weak and feeble. They're ruining their physical health. They become so spineless and weak. And then the ladies look at this bunch of weak, spineless guys and say, oh, I want to marry those guys. But why are the men spineless and weak? Because the ladies consorted with them. So what goes around comes around. You make all the guys spineless and weak. Not saying it's all your fault. They want to be. They want that. they become spineless and weak in the process, and then the ladies, you know, when they're in their late 20s, where is that gallant, responsible man with dignity so I can marry? He's nowhere to be found because you ruined them all. And you were able to ruin them all because they wanted to be ruined. It takes two to tango, so this is the problem. Like a kitten chasing its own tail. We always explain, you know, by the time ladies become 28, generally speaking, then all of a sudden, nesting time comes. Oh, I think I want to settle down now. Okay, where's a responsible guy who's going to work and be committed? I don't understand. All these guys, they look so weak. They look so irresponsible. Well, they're that way because you made them that way. That's half the blame. The other half the blame certainly goes to the men. They thought they were having a good time. They didn't understand it. They did themselves in. So we're trying to offer a program by which both the men and ladies can get themselves together. Detox. Just get the guys and girls out of your head for a while. If you want to go that route, then do it in the right way. Develop yourself, build your character, build your fortitude, your determination, so that you can actually benefit someone. So that is what's going on. So for those men who want the brahmachari training and the classic menial servant brahmachari ashram, we have that. For those who aren't sure or who feel it's not their thing, we also give a chance to be trained. And in the ladies, the main thing is how to be chaste. And we can see everyone is happy in that way. Aren't the ladies happy being chaste? You get some self-respect. A lady without self-respect does really wild things. But once you have self-respect and dignity, then you feel good about yourself. You don't feel cheap. When a lady feels cheap, she just allows anything to happen. Ah, well, anyway, what the heck? A lady should feel, as we said yesterday, very expensive, very exquisite. That means self-respect, self-honor. But when they've been ground under by the party process, they become hellish. They practically become mentally deranged. And we already spoke about how the men who think they're the big enjoyers just destroy themselves. So this is what we're combating so that we can actually repopulate society with some human beings. And Srila Prabhupada would always say, don't be depressed if you've had that kind of past. Chanting the Hare Krishna mantra with attention can counteract all that. So therefore, we do stress the attentive chanting of the holy name. That's what will counteract the atrocious past. No need to lament and be depressed and, oh, I did this, I did that, I ruined myself. It's true, but you can counteract it all by chanting the holy name. That's the advantage of the Hare Krishna mantra. Any other questions?
It's difficult.
You just have to be very, very mindful. Very, very mindful. Can't be frivolous. Analyze all the connections. As you were saying earlier, see how all the connections that you're involved with are proper and for Krishna's pleasure. I always pray to Srila Prabhupada that whatever devotee I'm interacting with, let it be for your pleasure. Whether I'm being very stern or very fatherly affectionate, everything has to be for impelling an increase in Krishna's service. It is possible. You just have to be very mindful of those circumstances. If you want, if you're sincere, Krishna will always help you. Any else? Yes. Powerful wife. She's very powerful. You don't get creatures like Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu coming from persons who are not very powerful. Now, both Daksha, both Kashyapa and Diti, very powerful. Who's Diti's sister? It's Aditi. She's the mother of the demigods. Diti's the mother of the daityas, the demons. Very powerful ladies. Krishna's pleasure? Then how do you say it's not karmic? Anything that's not for Krishna's pleasure is karmic. It's not, how do you say, it's not ugra karma. It's not like, you know, animal slaughter. It's not like, you know, outside of marriage. It's not like, you know, gambling, meat eating. It's not like that. It's not the, you know, this super atrocious stuff. But it's not a devotional activity, is it? So how can it be a karma if it's not for Krishna's pleasure? As the Bhagavatam says in the second canto, you don't go back to Godhead. You go to the heavenly planets. Take your pick. The destination, it says right in the second canto, the destination of householders who do not strictly follow household dharmas, and they don't go back to Godhead. They go to the higher planets. It's not atrociously sinful activity, but it's not the program if you want to go back to Godhead. You get what you want. Krishna understands everyone's heart. Krishna is more expert at understanding how to give persons what they deserve than anyone. Yes, there's so many adjustments like that that devotees have manufactured. So you answer, oh, so it's not karma, it's akarma. So akarma means it's for Krishna's pleasure. So acts of devotion are akarma. So certainly, as we said, it's not as severe as adultery or fornication or that kind of thing. But there is a reaction. It's not the initiation vows. So, if you don't follow your initiation vows, spiritual master has to suffer. That suffering just may be, you know, it's like someone takes some mud and throws it on you. You know, it's a simile. So the spiritual master sometimes, you know, gets this mud in terms of other people's material desires thrown at him. You know, what's this stuff? It's not me. Where did it come from? That's what happens. Mm-hmm. You have three choices: akarma, karma, and vikarma. Bhakti, activities done strictly for Krishna's pleasure. Then there's karma, activities performed for a material result. And there's vikarma, pungent, just disgusting karmic activities. So we're not into just karma. We want the bhakti. Now, we can cover both sides of the issue without propaganda. I personally heard Prabhupada say that when householders follow the regular principles to conceive a child, he said they can experience Krishna in that way. I don't have that experience, and I won't have, but that's what Srila Prabhupada said. They can experience Krishna in that way. So there, what more, how do you say, there you have a fair statement. Personally, I prefer kirtan, but but still, you know, we're presenting the issue fairly. Yes. Balanced presentation. I think you remember Ishvar Poria did my scorchers for 30 years ago. I know Ishvar Puri since 1978, so he can tell you what I would have said in 1978. Remember the famous class about Madhurya Leela? Sorry, then you're 28 years old, you know, fired up. Yeah. I think some of the ladies around the world, they're scattered various places. They still remember that lecture from 1978, you know. Sometimes they get, you know. Not anymore, but a few years ago, I get these messages. Oh, what about that lecture? You're a woman hater. Give me a break. It was 1978 in a brahmachari class. The first time I came to Sweden. It was the end of 1978. December of 78. You know, I gave a brahmachari class, and someone happened to tape it. So It went all over Europe, the class, you know, all the men were, wow, yeah. Then the political, social atmosphere changes, and so the same tape, 30 years later, what an unbalanced devotee. So you were praying, it was 30 years ago. Anything else? Yes? Mixed. Yeah, we have to get out of this false understanding that it's either black or white. Often it's gray. So the Bhagavatam is teaching you how to deal with a gray situation. She is a devotee of the Supreme Lord. So, you know, she just had a weakness. Is everyone here always, you know, fully absorbed in devotional service? When I'm here, everyone's smiling. Oh, Guru Maharaj. Is it always like that? So do we throw you all out because of that? It's mixed. And hopefully, if you keep, certainly if you keep at it with your performance of bhakti yoga, you'll become purified. There's no doubt about that. It's just a question of whether you'll keep at it. So we shouldn't like become so intolerant of a mixed situation when generally most situations in Krishna consciousness are mixed. Have you seen that over the years? Haven't you seen that over the years? It's not like all, generally it's not all black and white. There's all sorts of factors involved. And so it takes some maturity to understand that. So Diti was had this mixture. She was a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's why Kashyapa told her, because you are a devotee, and because you are repentant, your grandson will be Prahlad Maharaj. Your two sons are going to be hell, but your grandson will be Prahlad Maharaj. It's a mixed situation. He was a very strong son. After all, he's the future Narada Muni. What do the later cantos of the Bhagavatam say about how Narada Muni got in that situation? It was a big Sankirtan festival. Yeah, and he was cavorting and singing songs praising the demigods, so he got cursed. Take birth as a sudra. So obviously he wasn't going to be an ordinary boy. The mother didn't have a husband. So obviously he had to be a strong guy. You know, he was the man of the house. And he wasn't an ordinary person. That's the most important thing. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Glory to the world.